Yeah.
Accession number 27244, Mr. John Lincoln, Reel 7. Now, we're talking about the political situation that existed out there at that time. And if you could just go through that with us in a bit more detail, because I know it affects what happens next.
Right. Now, the government of the time, which was the Profumo government, must remember that gentleman, had decided that independence was the thing of the time. And the African states, of course, had all been clamouring for independence for several years after the war. Sierra Leone and Gold Coast, etc. And at the time also, it was like a powder keg because the other European states, like Belgium, for instance, refused to give independence to their people. And what happened was, of course, the Belgian Congo blew up, which was quite a messy business. There was also unrest in other African states like Chad and so forth. Now, all these states surrounded the British protectorates. The Cameroon, where we were sent to, had been German West Africa. And we inherited that from the Treaty of Versailles to be a protectorate, to be split between us and the French. So you had a French Cameroon and a British Cameroon. Now next to us, you had Nigeria, which was the next state that the politicians had decided would take independence. And all this was going on, the independence talks and so on and so forth. The nearest point of the Congo was Stanleyville and the Katanga province, which was inland on, it was at the behind the French Cameroon protectorate, more or less bordered onto it, and Central West Africa and all sorts of these all sorts of states like that. Because as you imagine, there aren't any boundaries in Africa. You can just walk from one place to another. The rolling savanna lands go on forever, and you don't know when you've gone from one country to another because there ain't any signposts or anything like that. So what was happening was the insurgents were moving up country and coming into other people's territories, and of course they were infecting the local natives with their unrest and their talk and so forth. And the United Nations decided that the easiest way to settle the Nigerian situation and give the Cameroon a chance to decide whether they wanted to stay British and go with Nigeria or become French and go with a French protectorate. So what happened was the United Nations sent a plebiscite force. That we were to be a police force, we were to be, if you like, hold the ballot boxes whilst they decided whether or not they wanted to be independent as a Cameroon Republic or stay with Nigeria and lead the French side of things to be the Cameroon Republic. Now, the French at the time didn't seem to be particularly bothered. They sent the Foreign Legion there. We had the 6th Legion, which were a sort of a marine airborne type legion. And they were highly populated in the French Cameroon. And of course, the French Cameroon had their own regiment, a French regiment of local people. So we were sent to the British Cameroons to be the buffer between the two. And of course, being the buffer, you get a bloody nose now and again, because everybody has a go at you. The Nigerians were surprisingly peaceable. There was lots of riots and lots of discontent, and a number of villages got burned when people disagreed with each other. But the main trouble was inland from the people coming out of the Congo and into the French territories and hence into our territories, which was the delicate bit. So really we were a sort of a police force That's why I suppose they sent an air portable brigade there, because you could move swiftly from place to place, which we did. I mean, we had the little aircraft, the Twin Pioneers, which is up and away, and there you are, you know. Because that part of Africa is a most peculiar place, because it's a rubbing together of two distinct tropical flora and fauna, if you like. You've got the grasslands, the savannah, which you've got wild animals by the thousand, and then you've got the tropical rainforest. You come down an escarpment and you come straight down whack into the jungle, which is almost impenetrable. It's miles and miles of thick virgin forest with a few small towns dotted about in it. So you have that situation to combat as well. Movement.
Now, where did you actually move into this zone, or did you fly in from your base, which we've already discussed?
No, we went there by troop ship, the SS Devonshire, and we landed.
Anything about that journey on the Devonshire?
Yeah, 15 days we were at sea. It was quite an elderly boat, one of the Bibby line. It was quite comfortable, and we had a good accommodation and so forth. But there must have been 2,000 troops on board. Probably not quite as many as that, but the whole brigade was about 2,000 strong. So there was a ship full, however many that was, and there was an advance party went by air before that. And we joined up when we got there.
Now, where did you land?
We landed at a place called Bota Bay, a town called Victoria, which was the capital town of the British Cameroons. It had been an old German port, but there wasn't any port facilities, so we had to land in assault boats, lighters, you know. Down the side of the ship, you've seen the American Marines and gung-ho and all that. Down the side of the ship, onto the flat-bottom boat, and into the shore. And that's how they took us off the ship. And then from there, we moved inland, mainly on foot. It was about 30 miles to the base camp from the shore.
Now, I've misunderstood a bit there. That this is when you first arrived back
The whole 9-10 months we were there.
It was when you were acting as a buffer zone.
We were the buffers whilst they decided if they wanted to be independent or if they wanted to join Nigeria. Meanwhile, Nigeria was going ahead with its independence and handover to the new administration, the African administration.
No, that's entirely my fault. So I'd urge them to ignore the bit about the Devonshire, because you're already there in a sense.
We're already there.
Now, what you were going out on these patrols, accompanying these patrols and the rest of it. Now, anything happen, or you know, any particular incidents you recall of the sort of conflict that was going on or tension?
Well, yes, there were several occasions when we went out to a place and set up shop as a medical unit, when the surrounding natives got a bit nasty. I mean, there was one occasion, there was a Christian mission rest house, quite a large concern, and in the middle of the night it went up in flames. And the locals were sort of threw anything available at us in the ways of rocks and whatever and so forth. And the old pangas were drawn. And of course, our lads went out and got rid of them. Not in the virtual sense of getting rid of them, but if you see what I mean, drove them off back into the jungle. And this happened quite regularly when we were in an area. The locals would, who were being stirred up, you see, from the outside, would get quite naughty and make trouble. But basically, the local people, the people of the Cameroon, were peaceable people. They all worked in the plantation, they grew bananas, that sort of thing, you know, bananas, coffee, tea. And being the type of country it was, with the jungle, you didn't move freely. There was one road that went north-south, if you like, from the coast to the hinterland. And that was mostly taken up by mahogany lorries, because mahogany grows in single stands in the forest. And what they have to do is they take one log and they take it out, and then they have to traffic it down to the coast to the sawmills, which was quite a large industry. And of course, this meant the road was constantly in use with these large lorries of mahogany logs going backwards and forwards, which meant it tended to limit our movement on road. So therefore, we went by air, if you see what I mean.
You mentioned, I remember we talked about the air trips before. Now, anything else you remember about your time? I'm not quite sure how long you were there for.
About 11 months. And then was a...
Any other stories you recall from that time? And we've done a lot about, you know, visiting the locals and providing dental care and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Any other incidents you recall from that time?
Well, not really. It was mostly hard work with the medical treatment and so forth, because they didn't have anything, you see. There was a great empty space, if you like, that didn't have any modern amenities, and that's why, and we were encouraged by the government, our government, to give as much help as we could, which we did. And as I say, these security patrols, which is what they were, there was a border of sorts, but you didn't know where it was, because it was out in the savannah lands. And we had two small towns, two small villages. One was called Pinyin, which is at one end of it, and there was another one called Santa Coffee, which was a coffee plantation at the other end of it. And beyond that, you were then into Chad and Central Africa, which were two separate states. And then going to the right, if you like, you had the top end of the Congo and the French Cameroon. So our borders, our patrols would be across the grassland along this demarcation line, and then we would come in contact with the French, the Foreign Legion, doing their patrols, going the other way down their border. And the idea was just to keep the insurgents out of our place, out of our territories, until we could decide, or they could decide, what they were going to do with their lives. They were going to either become independent, or they were going to go and join Nigeria.
Now, what happened then? So what's the next thing, as far as you're concerned?
Well, that just about sums it up. I mean, we were withdrawn in the March-April time. We started to withdraw, and there was another brigade took over from us for a short period of time. So we were sort of changed over, if you like. The Devonshire came back again with the new guys. In fact, it was, if I remember rightly, it was the Grenadier Guards Brigade, another independent brigade like we were, and they came in and took over from us, and we withdrew aboard the Devonshire again, and we sailed away back to UK.
Anything about, were you sorry to leave, or had you had enough of British
government? We'd had enough. We had had enough. It was not a very nice climate. Well, as you know, it was commonly known as the white man's grave. And I mean, there was every illness known to man, tropical illness known to man. The whole environment was anti-human, if you like. It just wasn't a nice place. It's a miracle the natives lived there, because it was their home, but it's a miracle that they survived any length of time at all with all the things that go wrong, you know. The wildlife and so on and so forth, as well as all the disease and so forth. I mean, the rack of diseases, you had yellow fever, you had cholera upon occasions, you had dengue, you had bilharzia. I mean, the list was a mile long of the things that you could catch in this place, you know. So it wasn't a very nice place at all.
Now, you left in on the Devonshire round about, well, April, that'd be 1960.
Oh, let me think. 1560. April 61. We went in the middle of 1960. was it, April 1960? I'm a bit hazy about that.
Okay, well, we can check it back with what we've done before. Now, so what? Anything about the voyage back, or was that just routine?
That was routine. We were greatly relieved. We, again, doctored Dakar. And saw civilization for the first time in 11 months. And then we got back to Southampton and disembarked. Most of us went back to our regimental depots and clearing stations. The infantry went back to Preston, which was their clearing station. We, the medical corps, dental corps, went back to Aldershot, which was our base. And the whole thing sort of just disbanded. The brigade was disbanded. It was considered that it wasn't necessary anymore to have this form of unit. Funnily enough, they resurrected the whole thing for the Falkland Islands campaign, because they found that it worked, this independent brigade that they could dump somewhere and leave for almost a year and they'd be self-sufficient. So there you are, blast from the past, eh?
Now, what happened? I presume you got leave when you got back to Aldershot.
Yes, we got a month's leave. Because we had no leave, you see, we had no leave for a year. So we got a month's leave, and then we were taken back to the central clearing station and dispatched to other units around the world.
So you went back to the dental corps depot at Aldershot?
Went back to the depot at Aldershot, yeah.
Now, what's happening now then? What's your next posting?
My next posting was Singapore. It was the very early days of air trooping. I was to go on the SS Navassa, but it sailed whilst I was still on disembarkation leave. So I never got to go down the Suez Canal, which I would have loved, you know, Ismailia and so on and so forth, and stop at Aden and so on. But it had gone. So I was sent as an individual draft, which they used to do in those days for specialists, like, you know, the medical and dental and Remy. You could travel individually. And I was sent on an individual draft by air, the first air troop in flights on a Britannia. 24 hours it took to get to Singapore.
What was the flight? I mean, that must have been fairly unusual in those days. I mean,
yes, it was. Yeah, we went from London to Istanbul, from Istanbul to Ghan, from Ghan to Karachi, from Karachi. Was it Karachi to Ghan? I can't remember. But these were the stops we made. Rangoon, and then down the Peninsula from Burma to Singapore. It was a 24-hour trip. I mean, you followed the sun, which meant that your meals were most peculiar because you got two breakfasts. And it was very, very slow. Very slow. And it was quite hard work.
And what month would this be? June?
Yeah, about June, July time.
And who were you going out to join?
I was going to join British Military Hospital, Singapore. 32 Company RAMC. To be part of the dental protection team for the Far East Land Forces headquarters, which was Singapore.
So dental protection team, that's what you were actually in?
That's right, yeah. It was called number 900 Army Dental Centre, which was the main unit, and then you had units out around the island of Singapore and as far north as Johor Bahru on the mainland. That was our catchment area. Then another team took over from there and did the next bit of Malaya, if you see what I mean. That's the way they arranged things in those days.
Now, what were your first impressions of Singapore when you got, you know, when you landed?
The smell. Because we landed at Paya Lebar Airport, as it was in those days. And next to it was a very large inlet known as Channel 5 by the soldiers. Chanel number 5. And the smell was quite spectacular because it was a shanty boat collection of hundreds of sampans people lived on. And they just ditched everything in the water, you know, sewage, dead bodies, you name it, they dumped it in the water. And the smell was quite spectacular on a warm day. And then we went by there by road from Paya Lebar through down past Changi and away down to the British Military Hospital.
And where was that in Singapore? Did it have a wheelchair?
Yes, it was by, it's called, they had the roads were made with a series of large roundabouts known as circuses. And this was by what they called Gilman Circus, which was down at the end of, I'm trying to think, Ayer Rajah Road. So it was, it's hard to describe, in actual fact, when you think about it.
What was the state of the hospital? What was it like as a hospital? I mean, was it a purpose-built building?
You know? Oh, beautiful hospital, yes. It was built in the colonial days. And it had seen many, it was taken over by the Japanese, and there was quite a lot of atrocities committed there with the nurses and so forth, and the patients, because they did away with all the patients as well. If they couldn't walk, well, they just bayoneted them, you know. And the rest, they were taken into prison camps. It had been there since the early part of the century, but it was very functional. Light, airy, beautiful wards, you know, with verandas and so on and so forth. And it was quite a functional hospital.
Now, what was this, the size of the dental protection team? I mean, did it consist of?
Well, it consisted of about a dozen surgeons and their support staff, a supply depot, which was in Tanglin Barracks, which is headquarters of Far East Land Forces. So you had the dental centre, the dental unit in each camp. If you can imagine, the camps in Singapore had been there since the days of the colonialism, and they were spread around. You had Nee Soon Garrison, you had Tanglin Garrison, you had Gilman, which was the Royal Engineer place, and you had Changi, and these were all sort of, if you can imagine, sort of a military camp, which were interconnected by the headquarters. You had 40 base workshops, for instance, which was the biggest Rimi camp in the Far East, and there was all sorts used to come there for repair and be dispatched out again, because Singapore had a unique state because it was what they call an entrepot port. Everything came in and went out again, and they brought in stuff from all over the world, and then they just distributed again out to the Far East stations. I mean, at that time, President Sukarno was in Indonesia, and he was doing a bit of saber rattling, and eventually he attacked Malaya. But that's another story. But that was all around that time, the early 60s.
Now, what were your duties, and how did you settle in?
Right, I was surgical, so my first posting was at the hospital, working in the operating theatre and the surgical ward for the dental surgical cases. And then
tell us a bit about that. What were you doing in the operating theatre, you know?
Well, I was an operating theatre technician. I prepared all the instrument trays and assisted the operations, jewellery sections, so on and so forth. And we had a ward where the post-operative care was done. So I did a bit of nursing as well, which was, it was that sort of a trade, you see. You were a general purpose orderly, if you like. And, of course, clerical work, because we were also, as the dental clerk assistant, you were also trained in the handling of stores and general administration. So it depended where you were as to what particular duties you were employed on. But I was at the hospital for 4 months and worked in the operating theatres and helped run the surgical ward for the post-operative care.
And any particular stories you remember from that? I mean, anything happened, or was it just routine work?
Purely routine. Extremely boring after my sojourn in Africa. Yes, no, it was extremely boring. In fact, it was that time I toyed with the idea of changing trades and becoming administration, permanent administration. And I got a posting. I prevailed upon the Sergeant Major and got a posting out of the hospital and down to Tanglin Barracks, the headquarters of Far East Land Forces, where I worked in the medical stores. And what we used to do was we received the stores from the United Kingdom.
That's Tanglin,
T-A-N-G-L-I-N, Tanglin.
And tell us what your duties were there, roughly, you know.
Well, we received the stores in from England, and we then had to supply all the dental units up and down Malaya, and of course on the island itself. So it was a matter of you spent a couple of weeks putting up the orders, if you like. It's like a grand supermarket for medical stores. They sent their orders in to us, and you'd make up the order, and then you'd deliver it. And you had a truck, and there were several trucks. You had to go up and down Malaya to the different garrisons. And I mean, we used to supply Johor. We used to supply. Trying to think. We used to go about 100 miles inland, to supplying the medical dental units, and then come back to base in Singapore, and then another lot from further up country would supply the other way, if you see what I mean.
So would you be driving, or would you just go out with the wagon, the lorry?
No, I didn't drive.
You
had Gurkha drivers.
Would you go with them?
Oh yes, oh aye, and it's for good times, because the grand lads are the Gurkhas, and they were the supply columns, and they'd run up and down the famous one road through Malaya, you know, you've heard it, the one that's got no camber on it. It's the most peculiar road. You had to watch what you were doing, because the lorry would just sort of take off, you know, because there was no camber on the road. And you went up through Johor and out to the other side and to Ipoh and places like that, and then turn around and come back again.
And you enjoyed that more?
Yes. I mean, I saw a bit of the countryside, you know. Much better than sitting in an operating theatre, thank you very much.
So how long were you doing that for?
Did that for about 7 months.
And what were living conditions like, at Tanglin Barracks or in Singapore?
Very good. Of course, again, they were barracks from the colonial days, so they were well-established barracks. I mean, in Tanglin we had a swimming pool and a cinema and libraries and a huge sports field. And, I mean, we had a good life. It was a good life. And, of course, you had native servants. You had the guys that did the washing for you. And the only thing I objected to, they used to put starch in your underpants. And that can be very painful. But apart from that, because they starched everything, you know, the whole thing would go into the pot and be given a huge battery, and then it would come out and be starched and ironed. And, of course, well, you could stand your shorts on the floor. You know, the wide legs shorts, you must remember those horrendous uniforms we used to wear. That they had shorts, but the legs of the shorts were about that wide. And when you opened them, you had to break the starch so you could get in them in the morning. So you'd put your hand down and widen them out, and then you'd stand them by the bed, because they were so stiff with starch. Mind by about 10 o'clock in the morning, you were wringing wet with sweat. And therefore, your uniform just sort of crumpled, you know. But you started off the day very, very smart and very posh in your starch uniform.
What else did the... how did you know the Malayan servants do for you? What would they do for you?
Well, you had what they called the so-so. She was a little old lady who used to come round and do sewing jobs for you, sew your buttons on, and ta-rah, taking a pair of trousers, you know, just general tailoring sort of duties. You had the guy that used to come round and sell you coffee and